Have you ever wondered why exactly it is that things usually sound better at home than they do on stage, in auditions, or even in lessons? It's easy to chalk it up to nerves or assume that you just have to practice more or get more performance experience. And sure, those things certainly are part of the puzzle, but a lot of times that's not really the true root cause. If you've been confused by the inconsistency of your performances, I put together a free 4-minute quiz called the Mental Skills Audit, which will help you pinpoint your mental strengths and weaknesses and figure out what exactly to adjust and tweak in your preparation for more consistently optimal performances. You can take the Mental Skills Audit online at bulletproofmusician.com/MSA. That's MSA for Mental Skills Audit. And again, it's 100% free, and it'll take just 4 minutes to get your results emailed to you as a PDF. This is Noah Kageyama, and you're listening to the Bulletproof Musician Podcast. Every Sunday morning, we'll look at a new research-based tip or technique to help you practice more effectively or help you perform better under pressure. And on the first Sunday of every month, I'll have a guest from the music, sport, or research world who will share their insights on how we can all be a little more awesome in the practice room and on stage. But this week's episode will be a little different. I'm not sure if the beginning of a new year is a time when we're supposed to look forward or backwards or both, but I thought it might be a nice opportunity to do a quick review of some of the most intriguing or useful things we learned from the guests we had a chance to hear from in the past year. My hope is that this will give you some new things to explore or experiment with in the year ahead and make practicing not just more effective, but a little more fun as well. I have to confess that it was a little tricky for me to figure out how to organize all of this, but I thought a good place to start was with cellist Astrid Schwein, who shared a few details about her daily warm-up strategy and how she gets her mind and body ready to practice in the most effective way each day.
One thing I've learned over the years is being warm, actually physically warm, is important before I start playing. And so there are things I do just in terms of I'm not a stretcher. I'm not somebody who actually stretches muscles right off the bat, but I do a little gentle aerobic work before I go to the cello, just gentle. I might do some simple resistance training to kind of prime my muscles and get me feeling just a little bit more in touch physically so that I don't go to the cello like whatever comes out. I feel a little bit like I'm preparing for the instrument. And then I've noticed that saves me lots of time. And that my first notes on the instrument are immediately things that are of higher quality and are easier for me to generate. And then my goal is to resonate the cello, figure out where it is, where I am, and just kind of get into the sound world. Playing for me is so much about what kind of sound I'm making. And once I get the sound going, maintaining its resonance, right? So that's kind of how I approach the warm-up. And then, sure, there are things about like sounding beautiful in all the registers, feeling comfortable in all the registers, having a good sort of postural balance so that everything feels easy. It's nice when you have that flow in your playing and in your physicality and the instrument responds. Sometimes it takes longer to get there and it can be a lot more challenging. So this is kind of a way to tweak that whole approach to the morning warm-up. And I've also recognized that getting out every day is tremendously important. And so that's been a big part of the day, like getting in a big walk before it gets dark, if possible. And if not possible, then what's my backup plan? So I find that's a very important counterbalance to the intensity of the cello and having to sound good and constantly, you know, keep making progress throughout life. So that it's not like a leveling off. This is how I play, but this is how I play, and I'm playing more and more like this, which gets me excited.
So now that you're warmed up, there are probably a number of things you'd like to work on. But if one of your practice goals for the day is to work on new repertoire, Danish trumpet player Christian Steenstrup shared an intriguing 4-step process for learning new music that might be a fun thing to try in 2022.
How can we get all of these things in a good, ordered manner when we practice so it's not too messy? So I actually came up with a strategy I think is very efficient, where we cover many of these aspects, both the singing, the mental imagery, solfège, and so on. I think it's very efficient. It's one of the most efficient ways of practicing that I know of. I call it the four-step process. So in the four-step process, we take a chunk of music. Let's say it could be two lines. It depends on how difficult it is and so on, but a little chunk of music. And then first I would sing it, and preferable sing it with solmization, solfège, with the names do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. There's some reasons for that. We can come back to that. And while I'm singing at the same time, I'm pressing down my left hand valve with my left hand. And that's a little bit more complicated than doing with the right hand, which is a normal for a trumpet player. I can touch a little bit why it's important. It seems like in our working memory, a part called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex of the brain, which is very much to do with working memory and attention and so on, gets much more involved when we are doing unfamiliar left hand practice. The contralateral hand, pianists can do it also, I know they do it also. And the same thing happens when we do solfège. That had scanning studies showing that when people are singing do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, they get also more of this dorsolateral prefrontal cortex involved as opposed to when you just sing la, la, la or something like that. So when I'm singing solfège at the same time, pressing down the valves with my left hand, it's very strong programming of this particular music. Then the next step would be the same music and now mental imagery. So I will imagine very strongly how it should sound, the auditory imagery, and also at the same time the motor imagery. I will imagine how are my lips feeling when they do this, can I feel the wind, can I feel the fingers pressing down, and all aspects of playing the instrument. The third step would be what we call dynamic motor imagery, which is mixing some of the mental things with the physical practice. And that is, I'm taking up the instrument and I am blowing into it wind patterns of the music, the rhythm of the music. I'm blowing into the instrument at the same time I'm pressing down the valves, now with the correct hand, my right hand. And while I'm doing it, I'm hearing the intended music very clearly in my brain with the best sound, either my own voice or imagine myself playing the best, or some performer that I like playing the instrument and so on. So that's are the three first steps. And then the fourth step is actually physical playing it. Then I often get the question, but that's only 25% of the time where you are actually playing. Is that enough for building endurance? And I have a little story about that. I had a student who was doing her bachelor thesis on mental practice, and she was a Swiss student, and she was interested in what athletes were doing. So she wrote a letter to Roger Federer, the tennis champion, and asked if she could have an interview with him. And he agreed to do that and had a meeting with him. And in his preparation for the big tournament, he's doing 25% physical practice and 75% mental practice.
I don't know if it's just me, but for most of my childhood years, the word practice was essentially synonymous with repetition, which wasn't much fun and didn't make for very effective or creatively satisfying practice sessions either. If you're interested in rethinking what practicing could look or feel like in the months ahead, it might be helpful to consider what bassoonist Daniel Matsukawa had to say about the three components of being a better practicer.
So going back to my approach to practicing and my approach to teaching is, number one is be a better self-listener, a better evaluator, we can call it that, a self-assessor. Then number two is to be a better problem solver, a better fixer-upper. And you cannot do number two without number one. You can't really, you're not able to problem solve anything unless you're able to hear what needs to be fixed. Anyone, a coach, a teacher, a conductor can tell you, oh, you're doing this, you're too loud here, or that note seems too long, or that note is accented where it should not be. Those are things that could be pointed out to you. But essentially, if you can hear it yourself, then you'll be best able to fix it. I always say this to my students, you are forever going to be your best teacher. I promise you that, like for life, you're always going to be your best teacher, because again, anyone else can tell you things, but when you hear it, you're always going to be immediately able to fix it and problem solve it. And now in terms of number two, problem solving, I always say go every direction and think outside, not just the box, but really if it doesn't work this way, then try a different angle and so forth and so forth. And I think there's always a solution. My dad, who's not a musician, he used to say there's always a solution, there's always a way. And I think this applies to anything. I'm not sure, and I'm embarrassed if this is an incorrect analogy and example, but I think there was something like this Princeton mathematical equation that was unsolved for years. And I think there was a time when two people eventually solved it, this problem that was unsolvable. And finally, you know, someone was able to find the answers. And these two different problem solvers who found the answer got to it from a different angle. They achieved that same answer, but from different ways. Again, I'm embarrassed and apologize if that's not a true story, but I just love that story, just even hearing it, because it's kind of what I believe. What might work for me may not work for you or for someone else, but we have to try those different things. And I think that's the key, is to not just think, oh, this isn't working, but my teacher is able to do it, and to not think he or she is a natural talent, but to also just think, okay, they were able to get there this way. Maybe that's not my path, but to just try it. And then number three, so we have one, better self-listener, assessor; two, better problem solver, fixer-upper. And then number three is to be a better keeper and retainer. So that way the next morning you don't wake up and you think, oh, what did I do yesterday? And you're starting all over again from the drawing board and starting from scratch. And you don't want to feel that way. And this way we really do improve and we get better. And then we also build consistency. Otherwise, we're just, again, it's just the reel just playing all over again from start to finish. And it's like you're digging a hole into the earth, right? And you're like, this project, like you want to dig a well or something. And then you had a good day's work done and you go to sleep and you feel good about yourself. Then the next morning you wake up and someone filled that hole. You don't want to feel that way. You don't want to feel like, oh my goodness, I have to start all over again. And so this is where number three is important, to just be a better retainer and a better keeper. And to start with, again, that's something I want to just put out there. And I think when I teach this way, I can immediately see improvement week to week from all my students, because I can tell they're now actively listening. They're really trying to, I always say this, look, I don't know what you guys are doing the other, I see 1 hour a week. I don't know what you're doing the other 6 days and 23 hours. And I don't need to know, but I also don't need to like hold your hand for every little practice session and tell you what to do. I don't need to tie your shoes. My goal is to teach you how to teach yourself. And so I should be able to teach you once how to tie your shoe, and then you eventually get the knack of it. Ultimately, is we want to teach the students how to teach themselves, because after 4 years or 6 years or however many years, we would like to launch them out into the world and just trust in that they can now trust themselves and they have the resources and the tools to do so. My students know I do not like the word practicing. I like the word familiarizing, and there's a big difference. And I'm hoping that makes sense to those who might be listening, that we don't like homework, right? We don't like that. We don't like tests. We don't like exams. We feel like, oh, you know, our shoulders go up. We feel tight. We don't like the word auditions. But if we change our perspective and we think it's not homework, it's not an assignment, but it's like familiarizing yourself with a piece that you want to get to know better and better and more and more. And same with an audition. Don't think of it as an audition, because your shoulders are tight. Like, think of it as your performance, your recital. Even change it to, like, change the word audition to your own personal solo recital. And when you go take an audition, your goal is musical mission. Your goal is not to land a job, because then you're going to sound like you're trying to land a job. Your goal should not be, I just want to win first chair in this youth orchestra. Your goal is to just musical mission. You're going to have a great mini performance for a mini audience, this committee. That's it. That's your goal. And then that music will come through. But if you're just trying to win a job, then that's the energy that's going to come through your notes. And same with again, that concept. So familiarizing yourself with a piece is much different than practicing.
I thought it was cool that much of Daniel's ideas around reframing the notion of practicing seemed to align with what pianist Vivian Weilerstein had to say about score study and her thoughts on how to learn and internalize a composer's language and style more effectively.
So score study, again, I don't like to even use the word study so much. It shouldn't be like homework. It should be more of a discovery. Oh, while I'm playing the melody, the cellist is just holding a note and the pianist is playing triplets. You know, that kind of thing is what I would mean by score study. Sure, listen to a recording to know how the piece sounds, how it goes, so to speak. And I wouldn't, in the early stage, want my students to listen any more than that. Later on, once you've developed your own ideas, you've been coaching, you're rehearsing, that's a better time to listen. I think it's really important not to fall into this trap of copying what other people are doing, and there's certain performance practice. And so this brings me to something else. You might ask me, well, how are students going to learn what Brahms is supposed to sound like? Well, so what I would advocate is if you're working on a Brahms trio, piano trio, right? Listen to the Brahms string quartets, listen to Brahms solo music, listen to the symphonies. There's so much to listen to. And yes, everyone needs to have a background in the style of any composer that you are about to work on. But other than, like I said, an initial listen, a quick listen, okay, this is how the piece sounds, I would really much rather my students listen to other pieces by that composer. And even if, let's say, later on in the process and this Brahms trio is sounding fantastic and blah, 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 there's no limit to how much one can learn from listening outside of your own genre. And I think that pianists need to know all the string quartets and the string players need to know the piano stuff. I mean, you would be amazed at how many string players do not know the solo Beethoven piano sonatas, and the reverse. The pianists don't know the string quartets. That's really sad to me. And again, I don't even like to think of it as like you should do it. It's because it's so wonderful. It's because it's so inspirational and so exciting to hear this music in all the different possible manifestations, you know?
Maybe there's not a way of doing this, but there's some pieces I think that we've over the years just heard so many times, even before we've gotten to play them. And reminds me of a masterclass where Fleischer said that he didn't say it was a little bit like the telephone game where one person says a thing and then another person does. But, you know, one person plays and there's this epic recording of it from years back, and then a whole generation of people grew up listening to that. And that just is now stuck in their head as this is how the Tchaikovsky concerto sounds or something.
And sure.
Any suggestions on how to approach the score as if you've never heard the recording and to try to really get a sense of what the original intent from the score might be?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's funny. I don't know if you experience this, but when I get my own hands on the music in question, because you're not looking just at a score and you're not listening to a recording, you are trying to interpret the music and you're touching your instrument, there's a huge physical aspect that's related to hearing and feeling music. And for me, that changes everything. I'm trying to figure out what I'm trying to talk about. Music is live. Music is about the moment. Yes, you have to know what you're doing. Of course, you can't play randomly. But if you have tried to educate yourself, ultimately, it should be a spontaneous experience. So the word experience, like one needs to experience the music as you're playing by listening to what's going on, by feeling it in your body, by feeling it in your hands and fingertips. And even your own, I was talking before about how chamber music is so exciting because you have the back and forth between yourself and the other people you're playing with, but you also have a back and forth between yourself and the instrument. The instrument becomes alive. At that moment, this is a brand new moment. It has never happened before in this particular way between that particular person and their instrument. And so that aliveness to me makes it possible to have a completely new take on the score.
This may or may not be what you're alluding to or talking about, but I think most of us have had some situation where teachers encouraged us to, you just play a piece as if you're composing it in the moment.
Yes.
And I wonder if that's something along the lines of what you're describing and how, because that, you know, it's one thing to do that as a solo pianist, and it's another when now there's a second person or third or fourth or fifth. Are there ways of doing this in rehearsal, or does this happen? Because there's a certain range, I imagine,
yes,
of spontaneity that's possible before it throws other people off.
Well, that's a great question. I really think that you can have that spontaneity in a group. I think that, you know, if you have worked on some of the things that we've been talking about and leading together, feeling the inner rhythm, reflecting it, the harmony, the color, coloring the sound together, that just gives you more and more tools so that you can be spontaneous. And the element of trust. So if you're in a group where you're basically feeling good and people are listening and you're doing all these things that we keep talking about, that's the time to take off and be spontaneous. And I think for me, that's the ultimate goal. And that's what all this rehearsing should lead to. Of course, that's in the ideal. You don't want to play carefully. But if you're really tuned into each other, you will pick up what the other person does. And also, the other aspect about chamber music that we all know is so wonderful is that it might not be yourself that's being spontaneous. It might be somebody else. And oh my God, my violinist just did something so incredible. And you're not really thinking about it. You're feeling it as you play and you instantly react to that, which just makes it so much more exciting and so much more creative. So the idea of spontaneity is just, it's a necessity for music to sound alive. And I think that another thing I want to bring up in relation to that is if it means that somebody's not perfectly together for a moment, or maybe somebody dares to miss a note for a moment, that's fine. That's worth it.
The way in which Vivian spoke of spontaneity and being connected with one's musical collaborators also seemed to align with what cellist Mary Peckham had to say about making music in an ensemble.
Chamber music was a social activity. It was very spontaneous in the moment. I've read about the wonderful parties, you know, that were just basically in place of today's friends getting together to watch some Netflix, you know, everybody got together and almost everybody played something. And they started producing miniature scores, if you will, of quartets, for example, for the people who were at the party to follow along. It wasn't for people to study the score and be prepared for the rehearsal. That didn't really start until like the early 19th century. But with the standards of the high level of ensemble playing that is expected in today's norms, you are expected to know the score. That's a part of your preparation. I think some people do more, some do less, but I think it's very helpful about how you're listening around yourself. And sometimes I feel, if you know to whom in your ensemble you want to send your energy in a specifically or particularly poignant way, and if you know from whom you want to receive as much energy or information as possible, that can be very helpful in helping a group pull together and really feel connected. So if you know in advance, I'm holding a long note here, and while I'm holding that, this is happening. What in my priorities should I be most obsessed with? Which part should I try to enhance the most? And you're making those kinds of decisions, then when you go to play that long pedal, and it might be a sustained pedal, or it might be a bunch of little subdivided notes on a pedal that are very energized, if you're listening in advance to another part with the same kind of intensity you listen to yourself when you're practicing by yourself, it's really something. You know, you get outside of yourself in a very intense way. I think that's kind of the goal. And that's also why I feel it's a lifelong work in progress, because some of my chamber music heroes, you know, are folks who probably were great at it when they were youngsters, but as they've gotten older and older and older and kept doing it quite a lot, they're just so good at really listening to what's going on around them and still playing magnificently, you know, bringing their best. to their part and what they're giving. So there's a lot of ways to, you can do it in how you prepare. I mean, I have basic things I think one should do to prepare to be able to listen that way, a little more proactively. I also feel that you can push yourself to do that when you're not in a rehearsal. This past summer, I read chamber music with different people. I mean, that was a lot of time music that I've played quite a lot, frankly, but playing it with different people. And even while we're just playing and it's so spontaneous, challenging yourself to try to listen to another part or voice with similar intensity as you're listening to what you're doing, it's really quite something to do that in that spontaneous way. A lot of happy accidents. I approve of happy accidents.
You said something about perhaps preparation outside of rehearsal. Maybe I misheard, but it seemed like you were maybe saying something about the need to do some level of preparation outside of rehearsal so that in rehearsal you can listen in the way that's going to be most conducive to actually playing with each other in a collaborative way. Are there certain things that you would recommend or sort of like must-dos?
I with the same way that I don't mean to be a control freak. I'm just really trying to help groups discover their dynamics. So when I say, this is what you're going to do the next rehearsal, you're going to tune this way, you're going to play through your movement, then you're each going to control the rehearsal for a set amount of time. And then at the end, you'll play it through again and maybe hit on some more spots that you all had in common or some things that never were resolved. I would say, and in addition to that, your individual preparation, I'd like you to do this, this, and this. I do have some basic score study things that I like people to do. You know, the very basic thing is go through and know every place you have the same rhythm as another voice. Go through the music and know every place that nobody plays. Grand pauses are sometimes the hardest things to get together and to come off of. And then also to write rhythmic cues into your part, really figure out what you should be listening for. If you have a melody, should you be listening down to the lowest pitch? Or should you be listening to the smallest subdivision? If you have a pedal, what do you think you should be listening for there? Write some of that or indicate some of that into your part. And of course, these days, so many people play off of iPads or some sort of tablet where they'll usually play off of a score. And then it's even prioritizing on that. I know for myself, when I play off of a score, sometimes I don't feel like I listen in the moment the same way I do if I'm not looking at everything. Because sometimes I feel like I'm hearing what I see instead of hearing what's actually happening. So I do think, you know, even highlighting the iPads with similar sort of things. What's the smallest subdivision? Who has the same rhythm as me? Where are we all not playing? You know, just circle that rest and make sure that we all are aware that we have to behave a certain way when we stop so that we can be together when we start again. So that kind of individual preparation. And then maybe the same way that one would talk to one student. If there's a passage, particular difficulty technically in a part, and if it is something where you're working with some, like an all bowed instrument ensemble, and you know, it's a particularly difficult bow technique, you can have everybody work on it in a similar way. You know, maybe practicing in rhythms or the way they practice with the metronome or how they're going to strategize fingerings or bowings throughout that passage. That kind of thing. If the individual does a little bit of that, and if it's a little bit unified, then when they come together, I think it is a little bit easier to let things fall into place.
Interestingly, what Mary had to say about being a more engaged musical partner was also related to something that cellist Natasha Brofsky and violist Roger Tapping spoke about, but in the context of how to better manage nerves and performance pressure.
One of the things that I found has really helped me is that if you're on stage and you're actually, you know, so you can get on stage and you can be kind of in your own head and really like fearful. And at that moment, you kind of close down and you stop listening. So if you just really focus on listening to the whole score and not just your own sound, but everything that's going out, your sound in combination with other sounds, that I found to be very helpful when I'm nervous on stage, I need to get outside of myself and into a bigger place. So if I've done the kind of preparation where I've both been listening in very imaginative ways in my rehearsals and my preparation, and also visually looked at the score both, that gives me that much more to hold on to when I'm on stage if I'm nervous.
There's a very nice, quite new book by Ed Klorman about the sort of origins of chamber music from the classical era onwards. And in a way, what he's saying is something you could say is very obvious, which this goes to what you're saying a little bit, which is that people often say, almost a cliche, that chamber music is a conversation, and it, you know, between four smart people, sometimes all speaking at once, but you can somehow still understand what they're saying. But there's a way in which it's actually composed in which, as you play it, you are actually intended to be surprised. So you're playing a melody, and if it were not for the fact that the viola player suddenly played a D flat, you would sort of play it quite innocently. But the fact that something happens changes the way you play it. And this is, it's almost like it is a little drama. And so the more you are hearing those things, listening out and reacting to them, or something is sort of pretty nice, but actually it's made extra sweet because somebody's playing in thirds with you. That often happens, or sixths or something. And what does that do to your actual sound? And thinking of these sort of things, so much gets you out of your own head, and it's how the music was conceived.
Yeah, I think this is what you're saying. It's kind of reflecting on my own experience. Hmm. When I was focused on technical accuracy, I do remember nerves being a lot worse. But when I actually started understanding what to look for in music and in the score and what to think about in advance, what decisions to make, where I was more kind of excited about, oh, you know, there's a really cool kind of dynamic contrast moment coming here, or there's a particular kind of vibrato that I've worked on that I think is really meaningful here, et cetera, which was not so dependent on a particular very narrow kind of technical accuracy. I do remember being surprised that I wasn't nervous in the same sort of way. Is that, I'm assuming, what you're speaking to a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a funny story that the great Canadian pianist Glenn Gould writes about, which may seem like a strange story, but I took a sort of lesson from it, which I think was the lesson he was intending. He said he was trying desperately to learn a bit too quickly a very difficult Beethoven sonata, and he was struggling to sort of find the technique. But he practiced and practiced and practiced. But when he played it best was when somebody came in and started making a big noise in his room. I think somebody was vacuuming or something. And then he found he could play it. And it made him realize that there was some sort of distraction you could do from the actual physical thing. And he went. And so what I took from that, and I think that was his intention, I remember a sort of passage that used to scare me quite a lot in a particular quartet. And the cellist plays alongside. I have a harder thing, and the cellist has bum, 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 and I've done it, but I've. And I discovered that if I really listened to the cello part and imagined I was playing it, because I'd practiced enough, you know, it was there. So you sort of, it's like how you go beyond even trusting yourself to actually distracting yourself, because actually the body has learned how to do it. Is that a good way to put it?
Yeah, for sure.
So if you can sort of access that, that's good.
So all of this is terrific, but if you're the parent or teacher of a young musician, you might have more questions about how one actually gets to this point. Well, there are probably some important principles to keep in mind, but also probably no one single correct or best way, as we learned in an episode with violinist Timothy Cantor and his parents, violinist Paul Cantor and pianist Virginia Wexstrom.
Just sort of the nature of these things is we tend to focus on when it was tough and, you know, when practicing was really difficult. But those were really mixed in with the moments that I, you know, very much cared about what was coming out of the instrument. And those times I remember both of my parents being just really interested and really supportive of me trying to help myself. And I think that likely happened as often as the resistance, because I think I knew to a certain degree, you know, what I was supposed to do with the instrument. And given my other practice habits, was annoyed when that didn't happen, which comes as no great surprise, but was a surprise to me, at least enough. And I remember both of my parents being really supportive when I played, collaborated with my mom from a very early age, and her helping me out with those kinds of things. Poor rhythm and pitch and anything else musical, and my dad helping me with those in the practice room as well. So there was a lot of that. I think sometimes it even felt like they were too supportive, and they would say, "Oh no, that's great, you're doing great," and I would say, "No, that does not sound good." And so there was even some of that. I think,
not to put you on the spot, Tim, but do you remember a particular time that felt supportive, where, I mean, whether it was a different bowing or fingering or something that your parents did to help you that came across not as critical, but as supportive?
I can't think of a sort of specific instance or a specific issue that I was having, but maybe the two of you remember better. But that was my sort of overall feeling that whenever I did actually become involved with an issue or keenly wanted to solve it, that they were always there and very willing to help me with it. But I can't remember a specific instance or issue.
Would you agree, Tim, it's not really so much about what is said, but a more general feeling of being loved and supported? Is that fair?
Yeah.
And that the two of you were around if he had questions about something that wasn't working for him. And...
Semi-around, in my case.
With your case.
No, that's one of the reasons why I feel very lucky is that any time that I did run into a problem that I felt that I couldn't solve on my own, it was just a no-brainer that, oh, well, my parents can certainly help me with that. You know, they were both ready and willing to help me on those occasions, likely because of my resistance. Otherwise, that when I was interested, they said, hey, this is great. Okay, yes, we'll absolutely help. But that never felt like I had to worry about that.
Along those lines, this is maybe just for me, but when did you know that the unsolicited help that you were really tempted to provide was going to do more harm than good? And like, how did you know to back off from that if those things came up? Or did you maybe not know to back off and it just played out the way it did?
Yeah. Well, for me, I probably didn't back off soon enough. Tim had a very interesting technique when we were working together at CIM, a kind of, you might call it a kind of passive aggressive thing, where I would say something like, do you think, Tim, hypothetically, possibly, that you would consider trying a small slide in this place? And it wasn't that far off from that. And Tim would say something like, oh, do you mean like this? And he would be a grotesque parody of what I was suggesting. And I would say something like, yeah, I don't think that's exactly what I had in mind. That was also very clearly the message was, out of my face, please. Do you remember that, Tim?
I think I remember the instance you're speaking of, it, but my memory of it might be a little different.
Fair enough. That was as clear a marker as I can remember.
Well, I think my takeaway from it is that even if there were moments where you pushed too much or pushed too far or, you know, set the decision date many years into the future, it still worked out okay. And it's not that everything has to be done perfectly every single time from the very beginning. And as long as there's a sort of understanding of support and love, that it kind of balances that. It's almost maybe like a relationship with any person in our lives where there are going to be good times, there are going to be bad times. As long as the bad times don't start to overwhelm the number of good times, mm-hmm. things still feel very much worthwhile and worth investing in and so forth.
Well said.
And whether you're a parent or a teacher, finding ways to provide helpful and instructive feedback while minimizing judgment and negative emotions can be much easier said than done. But it turns out there may be a lot we can learn from the world of animal training, believe it or not. Specifically, from a technique known as clicker training that has begun to be used in training surgeons as well as athletes and performing artists. Here's dancer and choreographer Anne Bergeron, who shares more details on what this might look like. Whether in the context of music theater or acting, what's an example of what this would look like? Like, what would teaching somebody in this way look like with a specific skill?
Okay, so with a specific dance skill, for instance, to do a pirouette, right? Turning, right? This, when we look at the behavior itself, there are actually about 21 component parts to doing a proper pirouette. And traditionally, the teacher would go, do this and demonstrate. And then, no, don't do it that way. Do that. You know what I'm saying? And a lot of no, a lot of nagging, a lot of not succeeding, as opposed to, okay, right now we're going to focus on getting the eyes around, spotting the eyes back around to the front. And maybe we're going to just do those in quarter turns. We're not going to try to go all the way around the first time. We're going to go a quarter and focus and focus and focus. And then we work on the eyes. And when the eyes become known with body memory, right, with physical memory, then we go on to the next thing. Now we're going to do the placement of the toe in relationship to the knee. And we work on that. And that becomes a tag point. Or and then we work on the placement of exactly when the arms are going to come in. Tag. Tag, right? And so we break down the whole behavior, which is huge because it's a lot of component parts, but make it very clear. It's pretty analytical. You have to, as a teacher, be able to break the behavior down. But for the student, it's like, oh, I know what you want. I know exactly what you want. And that, I think for so many of us, for all of us as learners, we get so frustrated when our teachers go, well, don't do that. Yeah. It's like, no, what do you want? That's the question that keeps coming up. What do you want? And so if you can really specify what we do want, it becomes a lot easier for the learner to focus on that. Also with Tag Teach, I'm being very wordy right now, but with Tag Teach, what we do is we actually funnel down the ideas. We create instructions. So this is why we're doing this. And then we narrow it down. And at the very bottom of this funnel, we create what we call the tag point. And the tag point must be 5 words or less. So we try to get rid of all the blah, 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 blah. Okay, now go. We take the idea and then we narrow it down to the instructions. And then we narrow it down to the actual tag point. And that gives the student really specific focus.
So initially you would explain to the student the skill that they're trying to learn, but then eventually for them to focus on in the process of doing it, the tag, mm-hmm. sorry, the phrase or the point, I forget the terminology, mm-hmm. but the tag point would be mm-hmm. 5 words, kind of like a, not a mantra per se, but just like a really honed in focus Absolutely. On what to keep in mind Absolutely. That won't overwhelm them in the moment.
Correct. Toe to knee. Okay. And I can explain up here, I can explain why we need to do that, right? Mm-hmm. And then I can say the instructions are, when you start the pirouette, take the toe to knee. The tag point is toe to knee. So like you said, it is kind of a mantra. It gives a very specific focus to the action.
And how does that get used? Like where does the tag point come into play?
So we actually use the clickers. And exactly at the moment, just like a dolphin that's jumping up high, right? And when they use the whistle happens at the point at the apex of the jump. And the whistle is the bridge marker that tells the dolphin, now I can go back and I will be rewarded for that. What we've discovered, and this is the fun part about working with humans, and we're doing a lot of studies on this too, I think, because I am not a scientist. I come from the arts. And so all my observations are obviously empirical, but it is crossing over to the science world now, and they are starting to do a lot more studies on why this works in terms of the neuroscientist is looking at why is this working. We know it works. I mean, empirically, as artists, we know it works. We're trying to get a little bit more scientific about it. But we discovered very, very quickly with humans is they didn't need the primary reinforcer. They didn't need the primary reinforcer of food, or in the case of children, we were giving them, you know, beads or something with every successful behavior. What we discovered, though, that with most humans, being right is enough, right? The yes is enough. That's all we want. It's like, okay, without judgment. And that's a huge part of it. When you get the yes with the clicker, it's like, okay, good. Again, I want to do it again. It's not, oh, that was so good, and we don't have to sugarcoat it or, you know, do all that other emotional stuff when we're trying to please our teacher or that kind of stuff. It's just very narrowed down to the information. And as learners, we like just that information.
Nowadays, I think most musicians are pretty aware of the importance of focusing on our physical well-being, at least when it comes to the parts of our body that we move to play our instruments. But trumpet player and musician health researcher Chris Chesky took a moment earlier this year to remind us that our ears and hearing are an often overlooked occupational hazard that we probably ought to be much more protective of, and that the most effective way to do so may actually be totally aligned with the most musically effective way to practice and rehearse as well. Here's more on what I mean by that.
So at the beginning of the cochlea, when the energy comes in, is transduced energy from acoustic energy to mechanical energy into hydraulic energy. So it's now vibrating through a fluid, is tickling these little hair cells. In the industrial setting, the hair cells along this tonotopically organized set of cells is a narrow band. It may be that band associated with what we perceive or have problems with speech, for example, like the top octave of the piano. It's like there's a band of hair cells that are getting stimulated constantly under this scenario. The other ones are not stimulated much because it's not much low frequency or really high frequency. And it's like playing a piano, you know, where you're just banging on those things repeatedly. Now, if you look at how the hair cells will be stimulated with the classical music, you got a broader range, just like the piano player playing the whole keyboard. So I'm down here for a while. That one there is getting a little rest. I'm going to play soft here, and I'm going to play loud here, and I'm going to go up here, and it's all over the place. There's much more dynamism in terms of the energy distribution across that set of hair cells. And that may be why it's less stressed.
That's really interesting. It makes me think of something I think a physical therapist or people in that area have talked about or recommended in terms of if you have some really difficult, strenuous physical stuff on your instrument, do some of that for a while, but then move on to something that's a little bit easier and not so physically strenuous. And then you can come back to instead of like spending a huge chunk of time just on that and potentially putting yourself at risk of injury physically. It sounds a lot like that, actually, that maybe we need to think of our ears in a similar way.
And imagine being able to operate as a musician or as a conductor or as a producer or a composer or an arranger with that sort of concept in mind, where you're literally writing music or conducting or picking repertoire for a concert in ways that maximize the ability to play really powerfully. Man, we're going to play Stan Kenton tonight, or Count Basie, or we're going to play Verdi, right? It's going to be loud. But we can minimize the risk by making sure we have really powerful dynamic contrasts in our production. Huge swings in energy level and variety of frequencies and content areas around, you know, the full range of the musical expression. Yeah, we can have a significant quantifiable influence on the dose. So the measurement of the energy literally comes down, even though the maximum levels go up because of this contrast over time. It's one of the most, I think, important and potentially transformational perspectives on how we do our music. So it allows us to create all the magic, but also gives us a way to control it so that we can minimize risk. I've got data, I don't think I shared it with you, which really brings home the connection between this patterning of musical stuff in a school environment and the individual who's controlling it. So for example, just like that wind band paper that you look, we did a lot of that stuff, and actually a lot more with jazz bands. So we have, you know, a huge jazz program here, and we have a room that is set up for an 18-piece big band. We have 10 big bands, individual big bands, and they roll in and out of there like clockwork. They sit in the same seats, the same room, the same genre, same educational mission. And when you start measuring it, you realize that there's a huge difference between the amounts of energy levels generated by different teachers. And one of the, in fact, this is quite a while ago, it was like 10 years ago or something, there was one individual teacher, I think it was a teaching assistant, you know, graduate student involved in the jazz program, where the levels were through the roof. It's like, this is really high. And we literally had a discussion with that person. And they were like, oh, it's the room, it's the music, it's how can I, you know? And it's, well, wait a minute, we have 9 other events that occur in here routinely. And in fact, some of these other 9 bring it down to a really, really low level, even though they're getting louder than you ever got. They're using dynamics, you're not. Right? You're not practicing your ensemble at pianissimo levels. Now ask any musician, what is the hardest thing to play? You go into a recording studio and you're getting paid by the hour. You don't have a chance to practice and rehearse and do it over and over again. And if it says play high energy, high pitch, and pianissimo, it's super hard to do that. It's really hard. I don't care what instrument, drums, trumpet, it's hard to play soft. It's a required skill for the highest levels of occupational engagement, right? It's a mandatory skill. Well, if you're not engaging those students in ways that get them to understand and practice and be sufficient in playing soft, you're also doing them a disservice, in addition to allowing this thing to potentially harm their hearing. So by managing the music this way, you actually have a better aesthetic. And anybody who's judging, like, for example, bands in high school, you know, I don't know if you ever did anything like that. You go and you watch a bunch of high school bands and you're rating them. One of the characteristics to rate is the use of musical dynamics. And the more dynamic contrast is, it's going to be rated higher. So you're serving lots of agendas by doing this.
I like that angle of it too, because it again reminds me of sort of physical safety, in that, you know, talking to people in Alexander Technique and Feldenkrais and body mapping and so forth, you know, they talk a lot about minimizing injury, but at the end of the day, they're also saying this will help make you a better musician. Like, it's not just about being injury free, it's learning how to play with more ease and effortlessness and fluidity and utilizing more degrees of freedom and being able to, like you're saying, you know, play super quiet and super loud and really have mastery of that whole spectrum of dynamics makes you a better musician. So it's not just about preserving hearing, but cultivating these skills that are essential anyway. So I like that they align in that sort of way.
You know, let me just follow up with that for a second, because of the 10 different big bands that we measured over several semesters, there was one that was really unusual. And it showed, because we were getting a dose measure every day over a 15-week period, right? So we could see how the dose would change, and we could actually see what nuances within each event influenced the dose, okay, which was really great. But there was one ensemble that started the beginning of the semester with pretty high-level doses, and then over the course of the semester, they just kept coming down, coming down, coming down. And I have a chart of this, and I have shown it many, many times, and I love the message that it sends, which is based on my discussion with the professor afterwards. And I went to talk to him about it. Dear friend, he's since retired. He has directed one of the most recognized collegiate jazz ensembles in the history of collegiate jazz. He was always the one that, wow, no matter what semester, what year, his ensemble always sounded great. It was just like magic. So I showed him this data, and he intuitively, immediately said, oh, of course it goes down. I taught them how to play musically.
The news over the last couple weeks on the latest COVID variant has not been great, and I think we're all hoping to avoid returning to too much online-only Zoom classes. But in case we do have to do some degree of Zoom learning in the months ahead, might be helpful to remember some of the tips on avoiding Zoom fatigue that Alexander Technique educator Lori Schiff shared with us in her episode.
The thing that makes Alexander Technique different from physical therapy or ergonomics or occupational therapy is the level of consciousness that we bring to everything. And the fact that you have to you realize that you make choices throughout the day. So if you've kind of slumped down in front of your computer for a while, you may not have made a conscious choice, but you could make other choices. And as you learn how to balance yourself well from the inside out, and not just, oh, sit up straight, now my back hurts differently because I'm sitting up too straight. Once you learn how to mitigate all of that, you can improve matters tremendously. You don't have to end up in a mess. So the kinds of things are just, it's the nature of sitting for long hours. One, sitting by itself in a situation that's not great and you're not particularly conscious about staying a little bit better. And then there's the sensory input that I find from Zoom is massive. I mean, it's just so much sensory stimulation, the sound, the light, the internet coming and going, all the problems we've all had, you react to them. So let's say you're a student and you've got this a session with your teacher who you're so glad to be having the time and you've been working hard and you start playing and somebody's internet goes funky, yours or the teacher's. And then there's some tension that just happens. You're just angry or upset or whatever. And then you sort it out and you keep going. Those things that happen there's no experience that doesn't trigger muscle tension. So maybe it's only a little bit, but it accumulates. So a lesson perhaps you were really well prepared for and everything was perfectly well set up and it was all going to be great gets derailed by Zoom. There's a lot of stress that goes with that, that absolutely will you'll end up with a tense neck and shoulder and back from that. So it's not necessarily just that you're sitting or the ergonomics of it, is the whole world that you're in. And the online experience also means that you're not, your space is limited. And not only you might be in the biggest room in the place, but your space is limited by the screen, where you have to be and what it shows. And then a kind of, I've observed subconscious, unconscious, you'll know better, reaction to being in a box. You see yourself. You're in a box and you realize you can only move in certain ways, or you think you can only move. So there's all of a sudden this other layer of unconscious limiting that starts to happen. There's an unconscious layer sometimes of people raising their voice. And then they get neck tension and all that from dealing with the microphones and raising their voice. So there's a whole lot of sensory elements going on. And there's visual fatigue. So there's a kind of an awful lot. One tip for people in the beginning that I was careful to remember to tell people about is when you're looking at screens, whether it's a movie screen in a big theater or our Zoom screens, we tend to blink less and eyes dry out a lot. And so as you're looking at your Zoom screen or your computer or whatever, remember, make yourself blink. It's because the eyes will dry out. And the other thing that reduces a fair amount of fatigue is to look away from the screen fairly frequently, like within every 5 minutes, because we're looking so directly at people. It's not quite the same as in real life. And there's not much of distance. I mean, you're close to a screen as opposed to the 3 feet away you might be in, or now 6 feet by design. But so I taught the students to just look above the screen, look out the window or a picture on the wall, and then bring your eyes back. It's 10 seconds of relief. And full confession, at some point after a few weeks, I was teaching and I'm watching the students and they keep looking away from the screen. And I'm thinking, why aren't they paying attention? And I realized that actually they had been paying attention and it was great. I was like, oh, they did what I suggested. It works. It helps. So there are things, and there is, yes, massive fatigue. And I certainly hope that people will give themselves a little bit of leeway. Hour-long classes probably should be 45 minutes. The attention span really is different. And the accrual of those hours is real.
These were just excerpts of the complete interviews, of course, but hopefully you were able to extract some actionable takeaways from these clips. If you heard something that piqued your interest and you'd like to explore it in more depth, you can find the complete interviews, transcripts, and episode notes at bulletproofmusician.com/conversations. And if you made it all the way to the end of this episode and you are hearing this message, I'm sorry to say that there are no cool post-credit bloopers or anything fun like that. And I guess there aren't even credits for that matter. But thank you in any case for your curiosity, enthusiasm, and support. And I hope you have a happy and healthy 2022.